Hello, and welcome to Always For Animal Rights, Ottawa's first radio show about animal rights, veganism, and activism. My name is Carolyn. On today's show is my recent interview with Dr. Corey Lee Wren, lecturer of sociology at the University of Kent. Corey is a sociologist who studies the animal rights movement and the status of non-human animals in human society. Much of Corey's work focuses on how professionalized animal advocacy organizations suppress and ignore the radical abolitionist vegan message. And that's what we spoke about in part one of our interview. Corey has written two books and more than 30 academic peer-reviewed journal articles about the effectiveness of social movement tactics, and she is the founder of the Vegan Feminist Network. So, let's get started. Welcome to the show, Corey.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So, could you please tell me a bit about what you do as an animal rights sociologist?
Actually, I do quite a lot. I guess I started out as an activist and went to Virginia Tech when I was 17. I turned vegan when I was 17, and I didn't really know that you could do animal rights as a scholarly pursuit, because back then, the turn of the decade, really, that was back in 2000, 2001, there was very, very few people doing it. And then when I got to start my master's degree, I got really involved as an activist, as the president of the Animal Rights Club, and I found that I was spending a lot of time doing that. And I was also finding that a lot of the things that I was learning in the classroom had a lot of relevance, but not necessarily that the authors, the researchers, the theorists, and the teachers, they weren't necessarily recognizing those connections. Then when I got to start my PhD, I had a similar situation where I started another organization, a student organization, and I really wanted to start incorporating that into my actual research as a PhD student, and I got a lot of pushback from my professors. So it was really at that moment that I realized that my activism is not just important to on-the-ground stuff on campus, but really to the discipline. I can consider myself one of those early sociologists who got on board with this, really at the risk to my career. There's a woman whose name is Siobhan O'Sullivan, who's in Australia, and she's actually been doing a lot of research on this about how about folks who get into animal studies have to face a lot of kind of career barriers because it's not taken very seriously. So with that said, basically, I do a lot of things. I try to promote the study of animal rights sociologically. I try to apply the tools of sociology, the theory and research of sociology to advancing non-human animals. And I'm also really interested lately in kind of just generic animal studies about how race, gender, class are all shaped by our relationships to other animals. So I guess you could say I have a lot of things going on. I do activism inside the inside academia, outside academia, and I'm also just kind of interested in animal studies in general.
Very interesting. Thank you. So much of your work focuses on the impact of professionalization within the animal rights movement. Could you please tell me about this?
Yeah, so like I said, I started off as an activist. So actually a lot of my research ideas come from on the ground experiences. So I have a lot of background in not just animal rights activism, but really radical animal rights activism. I guess you could call me an abolitionist, although I have trouble with that term because of its associations with kind of the Francione group who have some issues with sexism and racism in the ranks. But you could call me abolitionist in that I'm really skeptical of single issue campaigning. I'm skeptical of promoting reforms over challenging the use of animals, period. I'm also radical in that I advance veganism as a political logic. And when you're in the trenches in the animal rights movement, that tends to be a very marginalized space to be in when you're in that abolitionist rank. And also, by the way, I'm a hardcore feminist, and so that is definitely not a popular position to be in the animal rights movement either. And so what I found is that, sociologically speaking, there's very, very, very few people who study the animal rights movement because it's not taken seriously. Animals are not really considered, you know, something of sociological relevance. But more than that, when people do study social movements and they look at radicals, they tend to think about radicals as being some kind of bane to the movement, some kind of hindrance or barrier. So I had two things going on here. There's a misrepresentation of animal rights in the literature, is then it's really kind of invisible. And there's something else going on, whereas those folks who look at radical activism kind of disparage radical activists. So So from my own lived experience, I knew that there was something I could offer to the social movement discipline, and that number one, animal rights scholarship is relevant. And number two, radicals are not necessarily some thorn in the side, obnoxious barrier, but perhaps radicals play a very vital role in the movement. So what's happened is that in the history of the non-human animal rights movement, and by the way, this is endemic to all social movements, is that really with neoliberalization in the 1980s and 90s in the West, places like the UK, places like the US, Australia, and so forth, you start to see this kind of logic of rationalization and market economic logic kind of imparting it into absorbing into social movements. And so what happens is that social movements became increasingly bureaucratized, professionalized, corporatized, more like businesses than they were social movements. Whereas in the 1960s and 70s, they tended to be much more grassroots. So the animal rights movement is no exception to that pattern. But again, coming from my background as a radical, what I was finding is that I had this understanding that there's this kind of overarching theme about professionalization encroaching onto social movement spaces. But many activists who don't have that sociological training don't recognize it for this systemic kind of pattern. So what I wanted to see was what effect was this having? Because one of the major criticisms that the abolitionist faction levies at the welfare group is that once you become professional, you start to see a watering down of your goals and your interests and your messages and so forth. And what's going on there is it's because as you become more professional, become more large, you become more reliant on big donations, you become less accountable to your constituency. So I wanted to see actually like what effect is this having on the movement? Because right now we're all just running on anecdotes. And there's very little research that's been done on this outside of the animal rights movement. There's a few that's one that's been done by the one who runs Bitch Magazine. I think her name's Andy Zellweger. I can't remember her last name. But she did one on feminism. It's beautiful and it's a very approachable book, and I recommend it to anyone who wants to know about professionalization in general, what it does to a movement. And there's also one that's called Selling Out, and that one is about the gay rights movement and how corporatization and professionalization has really, really compromised the goals of that movement. So there's some studies out there on what happens, but again, no one talks about animal rights. So basically what I did was, okay, I did my dissertation research on this topic, and way back in like 2013 or so, I visited the Tom Reagan Animal Rights Archive, which was kind of brand new at the time. And I went up to the librarian and I said, all right, let's see, let's do some random sampling of different organizations that I knew had been around for a while, like PETA, Animal Liberation Victoria in Australia. I also did the Vegan Society a few years later. So lots of work at PETA, of course. And so I looked at these organizations and wanted to see what was in these boxes in the archive. And as far as what did they produce, what's written there, what claims are they making? So the librarian saddles me up with a bunch of boxes, and I just sat in the library and sifted through these decades of publications. And what I found was a very clear pattern where when professionalization took hold over these organizations one by one, you saw a dramatic change in their mission statements, their campaigning, the types of things they were campaigning about, and the type of language they would use to describe it. All sorts of things like that. It was a very clear compromising effect. And some of the folks, the other interesting thing about this professionalization is this kind of it's an assumed thing that this is the natural progress of things. Because we've all been so very socialized by capitalist logic, there's this economic logic of growth where bigger is better, the more wealthy, more powerful we'll be. But we don't stop to think about, you know, working within that capitalist system could come with some serious compromises as well. Because if you look at it from a sociological perspective, capitalism as the leading form of economy right now is really the root of animal oppression. And for those who are interested in learning more about that, David Nyberg just came out with an excellent edited series on animal rights and animal oppression and capitalism. So if you're coming at it from that point of view, where capitalism is a logic of exploitation, that's what it does, it's how it functions, how can we think that we can reasonably wield a system of really a system of violence in that way to liberate? So it's a book. The project really is challenging that kind of capitalist logic that has kind of permeated the movement, and getting us to think about how professionalization is going to have inherent compromises. We're going to have to think very critically about the limits of capitalism as a solution to the ills of capitalism. And also, I think very importantly, that activists can learn from this book and this project is to think about professionalization as a system-wide event, not just something that individual persons or individual groups partake in and are corrupted by.
Thanks for explaining that. So, could you please give me an example of how an animal advocacy organization has changed their messaging after they professionalized?
So if you check out the book, I have lots and lots of organizations that I have followed. I think the most striking one to me was Compassion Over Killing. And Compassion Over Killing is, it started out as a DC-based student group, and I think in like the mid-90s or so. And if you look at their first flyers, their first, well, I guess they're newsletters, but they're only a few pages long, they were very clearly homemade. They were probably used with a copy machine. Someone with a typewriter at home. So very rudimentary, as a classic student, you know, animal rights organizing sort of stuff. But then as in their literature, they would explicitly say, we are an animal rights organization. Their newsletter was called The Abolitionist. They would feature images on the cover of this newsletter of activists being out in the street and being arrested. So all that symbolism of really hardcore direct activism and all about liberation, none of this welfare reduced reform kind of stuff. They also, once they started to get their feet under them, they started to produce a Go Vegan kit. And so in the inside of each newsletter, they would have a mission statement that said, we are here to liberate, not to reform. And at the back of the newsletter, it would say, Go Vegan. And then they would promote their, sometimes they would have a Go Vegan kind of starter kit included with that. Then in about the early 2000s, they professionalized. And it is night and day. When they went professional, their magazine, their newsletter turned from this kind of homespun black and white deal to a professional glossy magazine. So you can see right away like how access to major donations and grants could, you know, boost their profile. So that's, you know, that's something to say. But you can also see the major degradation to their goals and their mission statement. So now, right away, you look at the front of the magazine, and it's no longer the abolitionist. It says compassionate action or compassionate news, something like that, compassion, which is much more wishy-washy, kind of feel-good stuff. And then you open in the first inset, and that statement against where it says a statement we're for animal rights and we're against reform, that's all gone. Now it's all about making things better for animals on farms. So the classic welfare logic. And then the try vegan or go vegan kit that they used to give out now becomes try vegetarian. And then on the back, each issue of the flyer that used to say go vegan on the back now says go veg or try vegetarian. Clear compromising of their message with that. And you can also see in the UK a similar, another example, not as extreme as Compassion Over Killing, but also I think one of the more tragic ones is the Vegan Society. So the Vegan Society has been around since 1944, it's been around for a hot minute. But the cool thing about that, and anyone's welcome to access themselves, this is actually there. The someone has put every single issue of the Vegan, the magazine, their journal, the Vegan, up online and on a website called issue.com. And so a few summers ago, I sat down and sifted through them all and started looking at how their claims changed over time. So it's a really cool thing. And by the way, I've actually published an article just on the Vegan Society. If anyone's interested, you can see it on my website. But it's also incorporated into this book project. So the vegan, you see, is very, very radical. Veganism did not start in 1944. In fact, the Vegan Society emerged out of a radical split from the Vegetarian Society. So since about 1900, the members of the Vegetarian Society had been really debating about the ethical appropriateness of promoting milk, dairy, that sort of stuff, eggs. So there were people, even in 1900, saying that, listen, Vegetarian Society, this is not doing animals the right way. We need to be take it to the extreme and include all products of exploitation. And then, of course, it was the same kind of pushback where people said, well, we don't want to go too far. We don't want to alienate our audiences. And so the very radical offshoot came from that. It was the Vegan Society. So in the beginning of that society, it was very radical, very clear. The early contributors to that journal were saying, this is about animal rights. This is about human rights. It was very, very radical and liberatory, abolitionist. But then the organization over time started to deal with the kind of the pains of when you have a radical message, to be fair, it's hard to garner a lot of the same su of support and financial support and whatnot. And so this is a major incentive for a lot of organizations to professionalize is because it helps you to weather the very uncertain tide of, you know, life in the world as a social movement. So if you professionalize, it helps to reduce that risk. So when you have periods of abeyance, periods where you have less resources, if you have professionalized, it helps to steady the ground a lot more. So the Vegan Society dealt with that same kind of problem. They were a democratic organization. Even to this day, that's a magical thing that has persisted, is they still maintain democratic access, voting access for members, which is a precious thing that's almost been lost a few times over the history of this group. But anyway, they did decide finally that they would incorporate in the 1980 or so. And right away, you can start to see the changes. The radical vegan stuff kind of drops off. They're now talking about health and recipes and food and travel and shopping. And then, and of course, that's gotten even worse today, where now you go to the Vegan Society's website, and you may not see anything about animal rights at all. It's now they've kind of focused on plate up your planet, plate up for the planet, I think is their new campaign. So it's a kind of that wishy-washy individual choice about helping the planet kind of stuff. And that radical mission about liberating animals is really kind of lost. And anyone who picks up an issue of The Vegan today, it looks nothing like those original journals. You pick it up today, and it's kind of like wishy-washy interviews with volunteers and recipes and page after page of products for sale, and really hardly any mention of animal rights at all. And this is not to knock the Vegan Society. Like, they, in order to sustain themselves, I mean, they had to make some choices. But the whole point is that, choices, they come with compromises. And we simply need to be critical and thinking very carefully about, are these compromises worth it? Is it always necessary to compromise? Are there other routes that we might take that don't involve kind of working, kind of giving over to that capitalist system?
Thanks for explaining that. So, can you maybe give me an example of how radical activists are invisibilized by the animal advocacy, certain organizations?
I think one of the best examples of that would be FARM's annual conference. So it's a national animal rights conference, and it's held every year either in DC or in LA. And they've been doing it, I think, since the mid-90s. And for those of you who are not aware of FARM, it stands for Farm Animal Rights Movement. And it's just one of the largest, more powerful welfare organizations in the United States. And this, I think, it was one of the more damning examples of how radicals were just flat out exploited, not exploited, excluded. So from the very beginning of the animal rights conference, it was kind of a meeting space for the who's who, kind of the big dogs on the porch of the movement to come together and kind of promote their agendas and advance their campaigns. It's also a place just for hobnobbing, and sociologists will recognize it's a very important kind of space to build your social capital, build those important networks. So what you'll see in these original mission statements for the conference is Alex, his last name escapes me now, but the guy who runs, I don't want to say it
Hirschaft,
wrong.
I
Yep,
think,
that guy.
yeah.
So anyway, his early promotions of the event, he would explicitly say, we want to have the who's who promoted here. If you're going to come here and be ugly and criticize, we're not going to have that here. And then even up to today, that's still happening. So for instance, Gary Francione, they let him finally come and talk, I think in 2000, and I don't know, it was a few years ago. They finally let him come talk. And he pissed everybody off so much with his critical approach that there was a lot of pressure for him not to return the next year. And the year before that, they flat out said, no abolitionists, like y'all can't talk. And so what they tried to do, it was him and it was Karen Davis of the United Poultry Concerns and some other folks. They tried to create another conference in the same hotel just to promote the abolitionist kind of cause. And the Infarm complained to the hotel, and the hotel shut it down. And then I think a couple of years later, Nathan Winograd, who is the leader of the no-kill movement, again, it's a radical group, a radical perspective, because it's the mainstream idea in animal rights is that we should reform, not liberate. The mainstream idea when it comes to cats and dogs is, reduce overpopulation, but we're going to have to euthanize. It's necessary. But Nathan Winograd actually very radically says that's the wrong idea. It's the wrong approach. We could come up with other solutions. But it's very, it's by default, it's going to be criticizing the mainstream approach in the animal rights movement. And so he was invited to speak, or he was going to speak. I don't know if he's invited or not. And then at the last minute, the organizers were like, okay, you can speak, but remember the rule, you can't criticize others. So he can't come in there and say, PETA, stop gassing and injecting dogs and cats. So he very rightfully was like, you know what? You're putting me in an impossible position, because that's his whole shtick, right? If you're a radical, you're an abolitionist or a no-kill or a feminist or whatever it may be, your whole point is that you are on the margins and you are criticizing these mainstream or ideals and ideologies that are problematic, which you deem to be problematic. So in effect, by, he may not, the farm may not say no radicals allowed, but by saying, having those types of rules, you pretty much exclude them. And most offensively, and I do say offensively as a woman and as a feminist, they also brought up a so-called safe space policy, which safe space policies have been designed by feminists and by victims of sexual assault from, because conferences tend to be very male space, male dominated spaces, and they're rife for sexual harassment and all that sort of stuff. And so feminists have been pushing over the decades for safe space policies. Well, Farm creates a safe space policy and then wields it against folks like Nathan Winograd, says, look, we can't have you in here bullying. It's our safe space policy, which I think is just a crock of, you know what? So those are the types of things that can be done in the movement to invisibilize marginalized radicals, because these are places where networking happens. This is where you get your campaigns platformed, your ideas are platformed. And for the smaller groups, it can be very important just for fundraising to sell merchandise and just to have that camaraderie. So if you're excluded from these major conferences, it's a classic way of invisibilization. And you can also see, you can see on the website for yourself, Farm promises more platform, more advertising space to those organizations who pay more. So smaller radical organizations who don't have access to big grants are not going to have the money to buy that kind of platform. And just to be fair, this is not just an issue with Farm's conference. Folks in the UK have seen this issue with the large organizations as well. And this is documented in my book.
Thanks for explaining that. So you've written many journal articles, and one of my favorites is about how flexitarianism is a form of social movement free riding. Could you please elaborate on this idea? I found it really interesting.
Yes. Yeah, so this one, to be fair, is a very contentious point. But what I'm arguing here is that these nonprofits are suggesting that flexitarianism is a way towards veganism without having any evidence whatsoever to back that up. So I actually used to teach social psychology, and I'm very interested in, you know, motivation and sorts of those sorts of things. So I actually went and did a meta-analysis. I went and looked at a bunch of different studies on flexitarianism to see, do people actually reduce when they say they're going to go flexitarian or not. And I found that there was very limited evidence to suggest that if you tell somebody to go, who advance flexitarianism, it's going to lead to vegetarianism or veganism. And in some cases, I think it was one or two studies where people who identified as flexitarian actually ate more animals. So what's happening here is that flexitarianism, like not to eat a lot of meat and dairy, that's seen as a social good. And so a lot of people already identify as a flexitarian, whether they really do anything differently or not. So there's a base, this is a basic social psychological kind of effect where, first off, if you're in a study and the researcher is asking you, do you do this good behavior, do you do this bad behavior, you tend to report in a way that puts yourself in a good light, regardless of how accurate it is or not. You probably may not even be conscious that you're doing this. But also, when these organizations are promoting flexitarianism, they know that it's something that everybody can identify with. I don't think there's a human being in the world who's not flexitarian, because you would probably die if all you ate was meat and dairy, period, never ate a vegetable or like anything like that. So it's very, very easy to say, well, promote flexitarianism, because who can be offended by that or pushed off by that? Everybody can claim that. So, but what I'm arguing here is that the science is not necessarily supporting that flexitarianism leads to veganism. When you look at similar studies on, say, the cessation of smoking, telling people to, you know, kind of cut back on cigarettes as you think is appropriate is not going to be effective either. You have to have a clear plan of action and a clear goal. So that's where the nonprofits get into trouble, because they don't have that clear goal and they don't have that clear plan of action, because they don't want that. They don't promote veganism. In fact, one of the main purposes of nonprofits in the animal rights movement, and I say this with all honesty, one of their main purposes is to deflect animal activism and advancement towards a vegan world. So the social movement system is, I'm sorry, the nonprofit system is actually supported by the state. It's supported by industries, because they know they water down, they compromise, and they buffer radical activism. And nonprofits, and I'm not saying that the folks who are in these organizations hate animals, but what happens is that they become socialized by that system. They become careerists. And there's so much research to support this. So what I'm saying in that article is not necessarily, I'm not at all saying that we don't want more vegan options. That would be silly. What I'm saying is that nonprofits are duping us into thinking that flexitarianism is going to be some magical path to veganism without any research whatsoever to back that up. They're not social psychologists. They're not psychologists. They're not sociologists. Most of these folks are actually trained in grant writing. They're telling us that flexitarianism leads to veganism because they have an ulterior motive, and that motive is to have a watered-down message that they can go and apply successfully for grants with.
Thanks for explaining that. So, what do you think that the animal rights movement should be doing in order to end the exploitation of non-human animals?
Have you ever heard of an organization in Ireland? It's called Go Vegan World.
Yes, I have. I've interviewed Sandra
Sandra
Higgins.
Higgins.
Yes.
Yeah, that's what we need to be doing. Period. That is a one-woman show. I think actually there's Barbara from Go Vegan Scotland has just joined on board with her. But for the longest time, it's a one-woman show. And here's one person who got a big grant. And this is the way of it. She was very fortunate to find a donor who believed in the radical cause because she needed that money in order to do what she's doing, which is basically very effectively buying ad space. So she got a chunk of money from a donor and she bought a bunch of ad space on buses and billboards. And I think she started out in Ireland in the UK, and I think they also dipped a toe in New York City for a while. But I think Ireland is very fascinating because it's a small country, it's a contained space, it's like one island, and she just has inundated that space. And it's a very, very deeply agricultural country. It's one of the biggest beef and dairy producers. So she just went right on in there, and she's been, I think, I really, really want to research this, but I think that that one woman with this one campaign that she's been running for what, 5 years or so, has been more effective than so many of these other organizations combined, because they just sit out there doing the work of industry and state by watering down animal rights and by interrupting animal rights activism and starving animal rights activism. Whereas Sandra Higgins is going out there and she's posting these billboards and just say it like it is. Go vegan because of this reason, or go vegan because of that reason. And she centers non-human animals. Non-human animals at the very center of her campaigning. And that is what is shown to be effective. There's no, the, I mean, there's some motivation behind health, but it's not going to be lasting. There's some motivation behind environment. But study after study after study after study shows people are motivated to go vegan, support animal rights because they care about animals, because human beings are empathetic. That is what motivates us. And so many people are simply ignorant to what actually happens in non-human animals. And for those who aren't ignorant, because veganism has been so ostracized, so villainized, so demonized, and so invisibilized by the main organizations, they feel like a weirdo by adopting veganism. So what Sandra is doing is she's educating the public, she's normalizing this concept of veganism in the public space. And what you're seeing now, Forbes magazine announced that Dublin, the heart and center of agriculture, like one of the most agricultural countries, was the most vegan-friendly city in the world. And you cannot tell me that her campaigning and her hard work on radios and on television and on the billboards have not had a major, major impact on that. So I think that that's one thing we need to be doing. We need to be honest about animal rights, honest about veganism, center animals. We need to actually look at the research about what works. And Sandra Higgins is actually a trained psychologist. We need research to support what we're doing instead of based on will this get us more funding by these corporate interests or from the state. Yes, we're going to need some funding in order to get some stuff done, but can we get creative about how to raise those funds that don't involve us selling out our message?
Yeah, I totally agree with that. That was part one of my interview with Dr. Corey Lee Wren. In part two, which we will hear on a future episode, Corey explained some of the ways that animal rights and other social justice movements intersect. You can find past episodes of Always for Animal Rights on ckcufm.com and at alwaysforanimalrights.blogspot.com. On Facebook and Instagram, just search for Always for Animal Rights. Please live vegan, and let's remember to stand up and speak up for animal rights today and every day. Thank you.